Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tomorrow, the Philbrook Museum of Art will host a day-long symposium examining the critical issues in contemporary Native American art. Titled Identity and Innovation, Creativity in the 20th and 21st Century, it will bring together nationally recognized Native and non-Native artists, curators, and scholars together to speak on the current trends in American Indian art that today often blur and sometimes obliterate the lines between tribal traditions, new forms, materials, social commentary, and non-Native influences. Our guest today is the keynote speaker for the symposium, Oklahoma Native Richard West, the founding director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian, and today currently the director of the Autry National Center of the West in Los Angeles. West is a Southern Cheyenne and grew up in Muskogee, where his father, noted artist Walter Richard West, taught at Bacon College. The day will include lectures, presentations, and panel discussions, as well as a curated tour of Identity and Innovation, Philbrook's current exhibit of contemporary Native American artworks, which is on display at Philbrook downtown. To learn more about the symposium, visit philbrook.org. Richard West joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Richard West, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to have this chance to talk some with you.
You'll be giving the keynote address for this Native Art Symposium at Philbrook. And one of the things it's going to be doing is celebrating Philbrook downtown's really the first time in a lot of years where Philbrook has really been able to showcase perhaps its best collection, and that is of Native American art, its largest collecting area. Identity and Inspiration continues down at Philbrook downtown, and that's sort of the title of the symposium. How are you going to connect these two in the symposium?
Well, I will say that I've had the wonderful opportunity to have seen the exhibit not once but a couple of times because I get back to Oklahoma, my homeland, with regularity. And I must say that the first time I went through the exhibition, I went through it with Christina Burke, who's a very distinguished curator at Philbrook, who oversaw the development and helped put this show together. And I think it's a very, very important one because what it is in a certain sense, a walk through Native arts, modern and contemporary arts and traditional arts through time. And yet at the same time, it is not a show based upon categories of material or chronology necessarily. And I think that's a good thing. That's a departure from the way in which art historians normally do this kind of thing in many instances. And I think it works here. It is really a show that is organized around themes, and those themes lead us to the taglines for the exhibition itself, which is to say identity and inspiration. In other words, it breaks it down into several different categories, beginning with preservation, where artists like other members of Native communities were concerned about protecting and continuing certain kinds of traditions that sat in the culture of Native peoples and were expressed through their art. On down the line through time into the engagement of Native arts, if you will, with arts from other places, namely Europe, Euro-American, modern and contemporary art, where you're talking about adaptation and integration. In other words, what happened when Native artists bumped up against artists and art from other traditions?
And what I love about that exhibit is it goes from what we would think of as the functional objects that are done in an artistic sense, you extrapolate a lot of those objects and create art objects out of them, strictly not for function, but for form. And then you have this juxtaposition of European traditions and Native American traditions. You see that how one influences, and then eventually there's a total melding of the techniques in which it becomes,
well,
hopefully, art, just art.
Well, I think that's exactly right, Rich, in the sense that what you do see also in that exhibit, which is very important, is that it is not organized along rather rigid lines, which had nothing to do with the way in which Native people created objects and art, where there is not a division between high art and low art and fine art and non-fine art. In other words, in that exhibition, you will see much of what my dad did, for example, which was considered fine art because it was two-dimensional paintings and three-dimensional sculptures. And yet at the same time, baskets and ceramic pieces receive the same kind of attention from Native creators that my father gave to the work he did. My father, for example, and I certainly follow in his tracks in this regard, never felt that those kinds of divisions, which are the norm when you're talking about Euro-American art in many respects, had any application to Native objects or Native art. And I agree with that. And happily, the curators of the show that we're talking about saw it exactly the same way, and I think it's stronger for it.
You know, that's a really interesting observation, because while that was even more pronounced in Native American artistic circles, it was just as pronounced in regular Euro-American circles until about 40, 50 years ago. You know, craft was craft, and now craft becomes fine arts or applied arts, and then eventually art. But it seems like that has not, those divides have been much slower in coming to Native American artisans and artists.
Yes, I think so, and I'm not sure you will ever see them. I'm honestly not sure you will ever see them in the same way. And let me take you back even beyond the last 40 to 50 years in Euro-American art and its evolution in Europe and in the Western world and in the United States. And that is that if you go far enough back to the time prior to the Renaissance, there was a way in which objects associated with life in European cultural and artistic experience, the same way that they are still carried on in the Native community today. It was really at the time of the Renaissance that art history took a firm 90-degree right turn and marched down the track of distinguishing between high art and lower art. It was a very linear path that led to the divisions that you have in the canons of conventional art history in the United States and in the Western world in the last century and in this century to a lesser degree. Those kinds of divisions have never been made, in my mind, by Native artists. Now, that doesn't mean that Native artists are not in a fine arts setting some of the time, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily have those same divisions in their own minds. Again, I know that artists of my father's generation and even the couple of generations after that, contemporary Native painters do not make those divisions in their own minds.
Why do you suppose they're so rigidly placed on them from the outside then, in the case of Native American art as opposed to, now I will say, if you talk to any person who works in glass or in furniture design or ceramics, they'll say those divides still very much exist, but they're certainly, the lines are blurring now.
I think they are blurring. One of the aspects of it, though, which makes it especially complicated for Native people, is that from the beginning and for a long time, which is why I think you see these barriers being more difficult to break down in the minds of some with respect to Native art, is because the interpretation that came from the outside of Native peoples, communities, culture, and art came out of anthropology, not out of art or art history. And because of that, all of their material was looked at as ethnographic material. And even those things which would have more easily fallen into the category of art simply because of the power and the grace of their aesthetics didn't do so, because the originating mode of interpretation came not from art history, but came from anthropology. And so it's been, I think, more difficult for Native peoples and artists to break down some of those barriers because of where third-party interpretation originated and the disciplines in which it originated. And, of course, anthropology, archaeology, or even art history were not things that came out of Native experience, and so it shouldn't surprise you that we don't think of it that way, but others do.
Yeah, no, that's, and it also makes it more apparent why art exhibits of Native American art often segregate by, say, Plains Indians or specific tribes or by areas of Native American groups. That's often a way it's displayed as really that sort of anthropological approach still to this day.
I agree. Ethnology lives on. But that is, again, one of the great things in my mind about identity and inspiration. It doesn't do that. it crosses all of those barriers without actually even mentioning them. You see art done by artists from Pablito Velarde to Helen Hardin to my father to other Plains painters, Oscar Howe, that crosses all kinds of ethnological boundaries and instead looks at it as something that really transcends all of that in the curator's interpretation of the progress and dynamism of Native art over a long period of time.
Is there anything useful in having those barriers, those ethnological barriers, in the presentation of art? Is there any reason for still doing that in this day and age?
I really don't think so in an art museum. I mean, the fact is that
if you're in a history museum or a natural history museum, maybe, correct?
Well, possibly, but even there, don't get too serious about that, because I think it can create problems there too. See, the fact is that if you're looking at how Native people would look at it, we're in this middle territory, if you will. We're not on the extreme wings of either art history or anthropology. It's not that we say the material you're looking at doesn't have cultural meaning in addition to whatever its aesthetic qualities may be. But what we are saying is that it is material that you can't just sort of define in conventional art history terms, or even certainly in conventional anthropological terms, because it was material with cultural meaning that also had powerful aesthetics that sometimes went along with it. And we see it in that way.
And so
that is the way we used it. And so to try to start making these distinctions which have nothing to do with what we thought about at all can sometimes be a little bit misleading.
And so really to address it properly, you have to address both at the same time, the cultural meaning as well as the aesthetic meaning.
That is correct. Yeah. And that is the way that I see it. And that is certainly what we attempted to do in my prior incarnation as the founding director of the National Museum of the American Indian.
Now, did you have any pushback on that idea?
Yes, quite a bit sometimes.
I would imagine some significant pushback, because that's throwing this sort of conventional wisdom out on its ear of how you should do something, you know?
No, I agree. It's kind of, we never thumbed our nose at anybody. We were very respectful of other canons of the academy, of knowledge areas, as well as modes of interpretation. But the fact is that we really did attempt to seek out and look at a middle territory that really sits between anthropology on the one hand, as we have known it, although even it's changing. Both art history and anthropology, as you and I speak right now, are in rapid movement in how they look at these things. And they are both, I think, moving toward each other rather than away from each other. In other words, to the point where you concede that objects that are created by individuals and supposedly one time were of universal meaning nevertheless come out of the creative force of an individual artist who may actually be reflecting certain kinds of communal values, if you will, in his display of aesthetics. And that's really what Native art was. And that's why Native objects and Native art objects have both cultural meaning as well as having powerful aesthetics sometimes. And that's why I think it was entirely appropriate for Christina Burke to be talking initially in the initial theme in that exhibition about preservation, because this was a time when Native people, in creating aesthetically compelling objects, were also attempting to preserve culture, period.
Yes. Well, we have to remember that the era of your father's work, he comes from an era where his culture has been demeaned to the point of active efforts to obliterate that culture. So
that's precisely
correct. In the creation of his art, he's really, by the tenets of the day, that's a subversive act.
Yes, it was. Native art was quite oppositional. And I know we may get to it a little bit later, but there's a wonderful example of that in a show that just opened up here at the Autry National Center of the American West. But you're correct. They were embedding in the art that they created cultural meaning that they wished to preserve and that they wished to have continued. That often shows up in the art itself.
How well do you think that's being explored in terms of the showing of contemporary Indian art, especially what I consider one of the golden ages of Native American art, that early 20th century, the first half of the 20th century? How well do you think that's being explored? The idea that this was a subversive act of defiance in a way.
Well, I think here's what's happening, I think. In contemporary Native arts, if you look at somebody like Bob Houses, you know, the son of Alan Houser, he'll be the first to say that he rebels against the notion of his art simply being an individual act of creativity that has some kind of universal meaning. He weds his art to what is actually going on in his own mind, but also in the minds of his own community. That's where it all comes from. So he considers it very much, in some respects, a communal act and not just an individual act. And I think that that has always sat in Native art. And you look even at the golden era, as you called it, the first half of the 20th century of Native art, when people like my father were coming to the fore, along with others there in Oklahoma and outside of Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Now we kind of look back from our present perspective, from the contemporary perspective right now, and we see these things and articulate them more clearly than they might have been articulated at the time. I think that is probably true.
Yeah. My guest today is Richard West, the director of the Autry National Center and the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American West, a native of Muskogee. His father was Walter Richard West, a wonderful artist and taught at Bacon for many years. And he's the keynote speaker for Identity and Inspiration, Creativity in the 20th and 21st Century, a Native Art Symposium this Saturday at Philbrook. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to talk about one other aspect of Native American art in its contemporary form. You see Native American art drawing on all sorts of inspiration for their work, often combining both non-Native and Native vocabularies in the artwork. But most institutions have a strictly held, the only way I can describe it is as a color line. It's either Native American art or art, but not both. And generally, if it is a Native American origin, it is simply Native American art. It's not considered art, even though it is art.
Well, I do agree with that. I think that that comes, as we have talked about a little bit before, from the fact that Indian objects, Native objects, originally were approached out of a very particular discipline, namely anthropology. And so everything was sort of categorized from the outset as ethnographic material. There was really not much focus at all on the aesthetics of the material. That's the way it went for a very long time. Now I think that we are bumping up against those barriers and simply knocking some of them down, because much of the material created by Native artists definitely has powerful aesthetic values to it. But let me just tell you one little story which actually relates to Philbrook rather specifically. And it involves what I think, as I recall, was a Northwest Coast mask, a piece of material, that my father was showing me one time when he and I were at Philbrook, when I was a small child, probably less than 10, maybe a young teenager or something. And he looked at the material, and he said, "The first thing I want to tell you is how beautiful this actually is." And even we Plains Indians defer to the aesthetic excellence of the material created by our Northwest Coast brothers and sisters, because it's really powerful stuff. But he looked at it and he described to me how, in terms of the design of the object, the materials used, the colors used, all of those things which go into taking an aesthetic focus on a particular piece, how beautiful it actually was. And then the drop note, however, was the one that he really wanted to come to, and that was that that really doesn't tell the entire story, because that was a ceremonial object, especially prized and valuable to that particular Native community. And so he was trying to talk about the wedding, if you will, of these two really equally potent aspects of Native art. And that is how he saw it, and that is how I think Native artists have always seen that kind of material. It's not that they didn't make aesthetic distinctions. You can look at, honestly, pre-Columbian pottery and find designs that went from one community to another because they were thought to be aesthetically more compelling than other designs. So it has always sat there, and I think that we're really coming to grips with this in a way that is very important and that eludes and escapes at long last the kind of anthropological overhang for Native material. which allows us to look at it also as art, as good as any art created.
I want to ask you a little bit about the National Museum of the American Indian. You certainly did yeoman's work with a lot of other people in getting that museum established on the Mall. And, of course, it's a great success now. But, you know, I think I've read that you've said it's very important that as we create this National Museum of the American Indian, and as we create a Museum of the African American also, that this doesn't become its own building of segregation, that we still have to address these issues in the American History Museum, in the National Gallery of Art, in the Hirshhorn, and the Smithsonian Museum of American Art, or in all of the collections, that this doesn't become, okay, this is where we do the Native American art at the National Museum of the American Indian, and it becomes a place of segregation. How do we avoid that? Because I think that's a real strong tendency, given the vastness.
Well, you have to work at it a little bit. Yeah, you're right. You have to work at that a little bit because there is that tendency, and if I had a nickel for every time I said what you just told me I said, which I did say, I'd be a very wealthy man. I do not think art, Native art, artistic creation, productivity by Native people should be locked up in an ethnic museum, an ethnic-specific museum, like the NMAI, entirely. And I always felt that and had some wonderful conversations with some of my colleagues at the Smithsonian, in particular Betsy Brune, who is still the director, actually, of the Smithsonian American Art Museum, about why that shouldn't happen, and she absolutely agreed with me. And they have begun, actually, making acquisitions in the Native area, too. And I think that that's very, very important because it gets past the barrier that my father and others fought to get past that was very, very difficult. And just a couple of stories in that regard, one of which does relate to the Philbrook, and which they know about, which I discussed with Christina when I saw this show. But my dad, I have a painting in my own home, which is one of my dad's paintings. It is not, you know, flat two-dimensional plains art at all. It is high abstraction. It is very much in the Euro-American mode of expression, and yet it is thoroughly Indian in terms of the subject matter which sits in the painting. And he finally got that, I think, into the
biennial,
biennial mm-hmm. at the Philbrook, but in a museum in Washington D.C. in one of the Eastern Seaboard museums, the Corcoran, which had a very distinguished biennial for a number of years in 1962, and that was considered really rather groundbreaking. Because that was an exhibition that was not just Native art. It was definitely an art museum. That was not a museum of natural history. And so it was considered very significant. And yet you see this back and forth. You're well aware, I would imagine, and my dad was involved in it in certain respects, of the time that Oscar Howe's work was excluded, I think, from a show at the Philbrook. It may have even been the biennial because he, quote, wasn't painting Indian enough. Because Oscar Howe, as you know, loved Cubism.
Yeah.
And some of his work that is in that mode is absolutely breathtaking. It's beautiful. And so we all have to learn this. We all have to learn this. And it is not just those museums that sit outside of the Native art traditions, or not, you know, Native art institutions like the NMAI, it sometimes is our own. It is our own. I mean, I remember the story about Alan Hauser being told by Dorothy Dunn as he was growing up at the Santa Fe Indian School that you never really amount to much as a painter because you don't follow the rules. And that, to me, is... You know, we're past that. We are truly past that. God love us and help us.
Thank goodness he didn't listen to that.
No, he didn't. In fact, he used to tell it and then kind of chuckle right afterwards.
Right.
But, so we're in a different place. But it's we really have to work at it. We have to work at it on both ends. We have to work at it on the Indian end because people must understand that our art traditions have been vital because they are dynamic and they change through time. And let's not pretend that something that is in the mode we may have approached a subject artistically 2 centuries ago is the way we would do it now. We have to be open to that ourselves, really. And then on the outside, I think there has to be that same respect for the aesthetic value and quality of painting that is done by Indians, that is not simply native art, it's art, period.
My guest today is Rick West, the director of the Autry National Center and the founding director of the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. He'll be the keynote speaker for Native Art Symposium this Saturday at Philbrook. Very quickly, in our last minute or two, I thought that you had retired from the museum business after the National Museum of the American Indian, but you went back and worked for a while as a temporary director at the Textile Museum and in Washington. And next thing I know, you're at the Autry Center in Los Angeles. And I understand you have a really interesting mission for working at the Autry Center, because you're trying to tell, like the story you told of the American Indian at the Smithsonian, you're trying to tell the story of all the people of the American West at the Autry.
That's correct, and it's very exciting to me, and yes, I did flunk retirement, but I flunked it rather happily. And here at the Autry, what is interesting to me is that I see it as really the next step, even beyond my experience at the NMAI. Just very quickly, the National Museum of the American Indian was very much in the mode of the multiculturalism that came out of the late 80s and the early 90s here in the United States. And in the museum field, that took the form of ethnic-specific museums. And I was entirely happy to be a part of that effort at the National Museum of the American Indian. It continues to evolve through time. But there we were really attempting to bring on board into the museum the very particular outlooks, approaches, opinions, history, experience of Native peoples themselves. In other words, we were bringing to the table voices of people who previously had been excluded from the table of conversation. But then the question becomes, what happens after that? What happens when you have all of the people at the table? And that's the Autry National Center of the American West, which I think has genuine potency because of the reach of its collections, its mission, and the curatorial staff that works here, that what we then try to do, if we are convinced that we have the voices at the table we need, we begin to articulate and interweave the stories of that art and culture in ways that are significant, both in reflecting on history and in informing the future and contemporary life and art going into the future. And that's what I see is the vital stake of the Autry National Center of the American West in going almost third wave, if you will. NMAI was both the first wave of colonialism. That's how it was established. It was established by a brilliant and wonderful collector who thought Indians were going to be no more. But that didn't happen. We were. And then the NMAI, under my directorship, I think was almost an anti-museum in that respect. It was anti-colonialist. Now we are kind of moving on beyond both of those, where we do have all the voices at the table we want, or we're closer to it. And then we have this third wave of trying to get at the interstices, the middle tissues of art and culture, by trying to weave these stories all together, sometimes in conflict, sometimes in harmony, but always interesting and always informative about what this country means culturally in its history and experience.
We look forward to your visit back home this weekend, and thanks so much for joining us, Rick. Appreciate it.
I always look forward to being home, and I appreciate your spending time with me. Thank you very much.
Rick West is the director of the Autry National Center for the American West in Los Angeles, the founding director of the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian, and the keynote speaker for Identity and Inspiration, a Native Art Symposium looking at creativity in the 20th and 21st century in Native art that takes place tomorrow at Philbrook Museum of Art. For more information on the symposium, visit philbrook.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.